Right. Now, for those of you listening, who've been listening to me for a while, this is someone I've known for a while online. It's really weird because you're online for a long period of time. You know of people, you've listened to their voice, they've listened to your voice. And then you finally actually meet 75 years later and talk directly. And, you know, it's this is going to be fun because I get a kick out of listening to your stories. And I also want to find out about you. So basically, I'm going to pick your brain.
All right.
And find out all of your dark secrets and then broadcast them. So.
Ooh, well, you've got a lot of work ahead of you because I don't even know where to begin with all my dark secrets.
I'm going
to
say this episode will be 75 hours. And
sounds about right. Yeah. Good thing I got a whole bottle of bourbon next to me.
Yeah. That is the thing. It's obviously the bourbon soaked stories. Is that the favorite beverage of that type of yours, obviously, or is there, you know?
It is my go-to drink, really. I find that bourbon is just perfect. Great flavor, really easy to drink. I can drink a lot of it and still maintain. And it's just, it's fun. It's interesting. I like, you know, kind of delving into the stuff that goes into making it. So, yeah, and it seems to be what follows me around when I have all my crazy adventures anyway. So that's how I get those bourbon-soaked stories.
And that is what the audience likes. Now, what I wanted to find out, because this is something that I've always found out, is there's something very similar. There's a through line between different types of live performers, people who are in rock, comedy, and even live theater. We all are, how can I put this politely, we're weirdos. So especially if you wind up doing podcasting, which is, you know, what we both do. But I'm curious, because usually if you go far enough back, you know, if you go all the way back, there's always signs of the performer, of the writer. There's always these little things in childhood that, you know, if you go back, you go, okay, no, that she wound up there. Okay, that makes sense.
Right.
So what happened? What did Tiny Juliet do that led her on the life that she's led so far?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what my mother would tell you. And this is the same story that she actually told David, my guy, when she first met him. And it was something that happened. I guess I was an adolescent, maybe just barely, might have been 10 or 11. And I was going to parochial school, not really getting along. You know, I didn't have a whole ton of friends. I was bullied. I was an awkward, you know, kind of girl who was trying to figure stuff out. And, you know, my teachers weren't really giving me any help with the bullying. So I had my little, like, you know, two best friends. And one day we were in my friend's backyard. He lived across the street from the school. And we found a dead baby bunny rabbit in his backyard. And let me just stress, the bunny was dead when we got to it. So, you know, we're kids. We start poking at it with a stick and we decide, you know, we want to do something with it. And me, always, you know, helpful and full of creativity, I say, let's crucify it. So we get some balsa wood from my friend's basement and we get some nails and we took it to the church and we crucified that bunny rabbit right there on the front door. And
you crucified.
My mother, when she picked me up, she said, "So what did you do today?" And I told her exactly what we did because I really didn't think anything of it. I didn't think it was wrong. I didn't think we'd, you know, really hurt anything. And I figured, well, she's probably going to find out about it anyway. Mm-hmm. And my mother kind of looks at me and she goes, "You don't feel like doing that to any other animals, do you?" I said, no, not at all. We just wanted to leave something for the jerks at the school. And she kind of understood where I was going with that, even if I couldn't quite, you know, verbalize it. And she said, "Well, all right, you know, your actions will have consequences." And I said, "Okay." And they did. And the next day there was a whole big meeting at the school because they thought some local cult had vandalized the property. And they held a big meeting to, you know, comb the school and see if anybody knew anything about it. And actually, we got away with it scot-free. I mean, my mother said there'd be consequences, but there really weren't any. So I figured, well, hell, you know, if I can get away with that, then I got a whole lifetime of stuff I can try to get away with.
Well, I can honestly say this, and this is really weird because obviously this is the beginning of my talk show journey. I'm pretty sure, seeing as how it has never happened before, and it will probably never happen again, where I begin a conversation slash interview with someone that includes a crucifixion.
Welcome to my world. And let me just say, so that's the first story my guy ever heard about me from my parents. You know, we're sitting down at dinner and, you know, David looks and he says, so, you know, what dirt do you have on Juliet? And I suppose this is finally the consequences catching up with me, because my mom's like, oh, I got one. And to his credit, he didn't run away. So, you know, we got that going for us.
Well, I want to say something also, because most people would go, well, maybe that would scare him away. But the simple fact that he didn't leave should maybe scare you away.
Yes, I know. What kind of person stays with someone who does that?
But it's really weird, because, you know, you have the rebel spirit early.
Yes.
Early. So, you know, and once you, because every time I talk to somebody, whenever they become something else, and like I said, I like to go back to the beginning, it's always in the 8 to 12 year range, when they're 8 to 12, where it's like, look, this is the blueprint, buddy. And
I think we're at our most impressionable at that point. You know, we're really starting to shape our personalities. You're starting to learn what you like and what you don't like. And I mean, that's about when I started writing too. I mean, I've always been a writer, but that was really when it became something that I enjoyed doing.
Now, when you actually began writing, I mean, what type of writing did you actually do?
Well, it started with a journal. I've kept a journal pretty much all of my life. I think I started when I was 7 or 8 years old, and I just continued doing it from there. And for school, you know, we'd be asked to write, you know, whatever it was, an essay or something about, you know, what your family did for Christmas or where you went on vacation. And I would kind of turn to those journal entries and see what I did and kind of form a bigger story around them. It was just my way of, you know, talking about myself and sharing the stuff that my family did. And I loved it. I loved it so much. I mean, it was just so cool to be able to put that kind of thing in words like people did in books.
Did you know that was a career? Because a lot of people will have something that they're good at, an interest, but it becomes something that's onto the side. Maybe someone's an accountant, but they're a good guitar player, or they're this and they're that. At what point did you know, look, I'm writing, that's it, that's what I'm doing?
I think it had a lot to do with my parents. Both my mom and my dad really encouraged me to continue writing. And it really became a focus for me, I think, when I was probably, it had to have been 14, because that's when I started listening to music. And between my parents and an English professor, you know, they're like, well, you love music, why don't you try writing about that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't want to just, you know, write about my feelings. I always thought that was a little stupid. Nobody cares how I feel about music, but I wanted to tell other people's stories at the time. So, you know, I'm some crazy 14-year-old girl. I'm hunting down local bands and asking to interview them. And, you know, I figured, well, hell, this is my way into the rock and roll scene. Mm-hmm. And it was both a tool and an outlet to, you know, start building a career.
I just imagine the crap that you saw.
I mean, this was the height of the hairband days. And I was a very mature 14-year-old girl. So, you know, going on to band buses. I mean, I was interviewing bands like Motley Crue by the time I was 16. Mm. I was, you know, like Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous. That's just, you know, what I did. And it was a very, very crazy, exactly what you think it is world.
Because, yeah, because, see, I'm 52. So right around that time, I just... I just that's why I'm laughing, because I know that because I know that, like I said, that's the rock star side. So even on the comedy side, I know what was going on then. Mm-hmm. So I'm going, when you're talking about Motley Crue and, you know, Sticks, and it's just one of those things where you're going, what in the, because you walk in and you go, what the hell is,
yeah, well, you know, that's just it. Like, it was for me, you know, at 16, you think you were in the coolest place in the world. You know, you look at these guys that, you know, you idolize and you're like, oh, you know, I'm with them. I'm with the band. I'm interviewing them. I'm bigger than life too. And then, you know, my perspective changed entirely come, you know, my mid-20s after living in Los Angeles and being a part of the scene for so long. You burn out super quick living like that.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing I was wondering about, that because I know, because it's like an athlete that jumps right out of high school into the NBA and the wear and tear on the body starts early. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really does. I mean, you know, for me, it was a combination of my liver and my brain.
Because this is the thing I was curious about, because I knew that you had started the writing process in your teens. Mm-hmm. When you go, I mean, because I know what goes on these tour buses. I mean, come on. So did you feel uncomfortable or unsafe around these dudes?
Yes, sometimes I did. And for some of the more uncomfortable potential situations, my dad would actually go with me on some of my interviews and pose as my photographer. Now, and my dad wasn't your typical, you know, dad. He's this crazy physicist. He's, at the time, he had really long gray hair that he wore in a ponytail, kind of almost like Willie Nelson a little bit. And, you know, he just looked like a regular, you know, rock photographer. So he was never my dad, but he was always there in the background to kind of keep an eye on things. Yeah. So he made it far more comfortable than it probably would have been if it was just me alone. But, you know, then again, I was also very crafty and I did a lot of these things, you know, through a whole web of lies and deception so that my parents didn't know about them.
Yeah, just be glad that I wasn't your dad on the bus at that time. Because MTV News, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, dude whips entire band's ass for looking at his daughter too long.
My dad has a tremendous amount of patience, I will say that much.
I was just thinking about that. I was just imagining going on the bus. You're on the bus. I just walk up and whoop one person's ass. I just want to let you know what could happen to the rest of you. Now she's going to ask some questions. If I even heard one curse word, I'm poking one of you in the throat. Go.
And you know, I mean, it's amazing. He always maintained character. He never broke. He never pulled the dad card. But whenever I would bring home somebody to date, oh, my dad was brutal. You know, he'd sit there in the living room and we had this bearskin rug on the floor that he had actually hunted and shot and, you know, skinned himself. And he'd sit there and just kind of stare at the guy and he'd look at him and he'd go, "You see that rug there? I did that and I can do it again."
Yes.
And these poor kids, I mean, you know, it's just some 16-year-old boy, you know, or actually probably a 22-year-old, let's be honest. And, you know, he'd just be sitting there quaking and then we'd leave and he wouldn't touch me. He wouldn't even look at me. And I'd be like, oh, God damn it. What did my dad do now?
I'm not going to lie. I don't have any kids, but I had some of my teenage relatives stay with me. And, you know, I'll be honest. I polished a hammer in front of a couple of dudes. What's going on, man? I'm a cousin. How's it going? Yeah.
I got control here. Yeah.
It's funny how you can get blood off these hammers really good, but these microfiber cloths get all the blood off, you know? You know, because that was the thing that always fascinated me, because I know that you had to have traveled, especially after you got, when you became 18 years old. Now you're a grown woman. Now it's all on you, and he can't go everywhere with you. He can't go everywhere, so it's just you now. And
exactly,
oy vey, because I mean, just the drugs, the boom boom jiggy boom, the boom jiggy jiggy, you know.
Oh, I know. I'm amazed I remember half of what happened. That's why I'm glad I journaled.
You know, but what did you think when you got an opportunity to meet people that you know, you bought the music. You probably got samples of the music, but, and I'm sure, obviously, you bought some of it, obviously, but you listen to the music, you love the bands, you get to see them performing, you get to see them in their rock god status. And the people in the audience, all they get to see is, yeah, cherry pie. That's all they get to see. But backstage, you get to see the guys come off the stage after a 2-hour concert. And then all of a sudden, the real personality kicks in. You know, were the people that were just so, I mean, I just, because I like some of those bands myself, you know. And so when you meet them and you have an opportunity now, you're, because if, as a journalist, they're just going to be themselves around you because you're not, or did they hide stuff from, even though when they realized you were there?
You know, it was, I feel two ways about it right now. In the moment, I thought it was the coolest thing in the world that I could be doing. And then after, you know, having lived through it and, you know, coming off of this huge rush into a more corporate world, I kind of started to get a huge distaste for it because, you know, these guys are really just regular people. They truly are. Some of them are phenomenal musicians. You know, they do amazing things. They play for huge crowds, but at the end of the day, they really are just people. And there is a ton of work that goes into being a musician. And it starts even just at the local level, you know, being with a band who's playing a club. You know, they don't just show up and turn into rock stars. You know, there is hauling gear. There's dealing with angry club managers. There's, you know, doing sound check. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's this huge, tedious process. And, you know, by the time you're done, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, you're either raging on drugs if you're a rock star or, you know, you're beat. So, you know, I love the fantasy of it, but I also know that it's definitely a hard, hard business. And I understand why so many people turn to drugs and alcohol to get through it.
It's just the ones that I've seen backstage, you know, performers of different styles admire the performer of another style. Mm-hmm. So I would have all the musicians around me asking me, how do you do that? And I'm going, the hell with that. How do you do that? You know,
right.
You know?
I love the respect that musicians have for each other. You know, when they can, you know, when we can trade tips and, you know, kind of have this shared experience that not a lot of people have. And, you know, it's the same with any field. I love listening to comedians talk to each other. I love hearing them break down jokes and revel at how people tell, you know, certain punchlines. I find that kind of fascinating, the way the mind works that way.
I get a kick out of all of that because I was sitting at a diner with a bunch of actors, comics, and musicians. And at first we're all talking to each other, boo, boo, boo. Then as the night goes on, people start to disappear and go off and go their own way. And you'd see a couple of guitarists were sitting next to me and they're sitting there. And it was like, these were older guys, not famous, but, you know, regional guys. And the enthusiasm with the minutia of one guitar string. And I'm sitting there going, are you two jackasses talking about the F chord or whatever? You go, yeah, man, because if you do it with the finger this way, bro, and the thing with your elbow, I'm like, oh my God. You know, and
we are all geeks at heart. In one way or another, we all are geeks.
I of course took the opportunity to torture them for 10 minutes because that's what I do. And, yes. but it was just the funniest thing. And I can imagine what it's like when you get a couple of authors together. Oy vey.
Actually, I would never recommend being in the room with a bunch of authors. In fact, I don't even want to be in the room with a bunch of writers. I don't. Writers are tedious and obnoxious and annoying. I mean, no offense to all the writers out there, but truly, I don't even like my own company when I'm writing. So never hang out with a writer.
And I just want to let everybody know that's a writer out there. When you come to reviews of me, that was Juliet Miranda saying that S. Anthony Thomas thinks you guys are incredible. I just wanted to point that out. I think you guys are super talented and everything she says is wrong. I'm sorry. I got to cover myself. So, you know, got to take care of myself here. No offense, but
And you know, I say that with all of the respect of a writer, I know what goes into it, and I know it's really brutal, and I don't recommend anybody become a writer, but just personally speaking, man, I can't hang out with other writers. It's too much.
Was it, what, how did you feel as far, I mean, referring to the touring with the bands and things of that nature, when you branched out into different things, as far as being a writer was concerned, did it pale in comparison when you started to work on other things instead of the rock
music? It was a different kind of creative rush in a way. So the backstory is that, you know, I lived in Los Angeles, and when, you know, the music industry changed, when, you know, the .com boom happened, I was out of work for a long, long time. And I was trying to get gigs wherever I could. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't happening. I mean, I was for almost 6 months, I was very nearly homeless. So I moved back to Chicago, and in Chicago, I was able to start working in more corporate positions as, you know, as a TV writer, as a magazine editor. I mean, just doing all sorts of crazy stuff all over the place. And I think the biggest hurdle initially was realizing that, you know, I couldn't behave the same way that I did in the rock industry. You know, I couldn't show up wearing, you know, thigh-high boots and, you know, a little mini skirt. It just wasn't appropriate. you know, my attitude, you know, if I wanted to tell someone to go fuck themselves, I couldn't do that anymore. It just didn't work that way. So I had to really retrain myself to be a professional. And then, you know, once I kind of got the hang of being in the corporate world, you know, then I could more enjoy the writing I was doing. You know, I've worked on a lot of commercials and done some TV shows and things like that. And that's really cool. It's an entirely different vibe. You know, you still get that, you know, creative push, you know, you get that drive to get things done on schedule. And it really trains you to be a hard worker, which you don't have to be when you're a writer in the music scene.
They must have, I mean, so essentially, obviously, you got infinitely more notes.
Yes.
And I said it that way because I've had, you know, some similar experiences where you get notes. if you understand what I'm saying, hey, this is well done. I've never written anything. I barely read, but let me give you some notes.
Yes, the client is always right, no matter how wrong they are.
You're going, oh my God. It's one of those things where, you know, you do your best acting work when the person is see, everybody, no one minds being critiqued. And I understand that, even if somebody doesn't have, you know, your specific level of expertise or experience or talent. And this is not to denigrate the other person, but they're not in the world like that. They, you know, it's almost like they were kind of given the power to deal with an artist or some a content creator because it's like a drug that has an off shelf, an off shelf use. So they don't really know anything about, but it's under their purview now. So they come in with the notes basically to make themselves seem like they're doing something. And
yes,
the best acting job you will ever do is listening to someone tell you how to do something. And you, from word one, know this person has no idea what the hell they're talking about.
Yes. it's the worst. I mean, and what's truly terrible is just, especially when, say, you know, you're working on a piece for a higher profile client, and you know, they come back with just the minutiae. You know, we're talking about something that's going to go in a far remote corner of their website that nobody's going to see. And they give you errors, or they give you edits that are technically wrong, that are so far wrong, it pains you to make them, because no amount of arguing in the world is going to make them accept that they are wrong. You know, and that's, you know, it's just the thing. I had to develop the mentality that, you know, the second I hit send on something, it ceases to be mine. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to step away from it. It is now the client's, and, you know, whatever it is they want, it's just going to have to be that way.
Miss Miranda, my client has a few suggestions. Let me read them off to you. On the website, I know the actual website is white, but he really likes white lettering. Could you put the white lettering on top of the white back? No one's going to be able to see it. It doesn't matter. He likes that.
If you're lucky, you will have a good, you know, creative director or somebody who can maybe talk them off the ledge. But I'm so glad I don't have to deal with that anymore.
The funniest thing about it is when you're dealing with the creative director is the simple fact that, especially if you know they're good, mm-hmm. and you can see that their face hurts from rolling their eyes so much.
I know. You know, the best part is always, you know, say you're having a meeting in house after the client leaves, and then everybody's just sitting at a conference table or whatever, and you all just look at each other and you see the collective exhale, just like, oh, thank God they're gone.
That was,
you know, and you just like, you start laughing because it's just been so brutal.
Oh, God. I know walking into the office, you watch the boardroom, you walk into the room and you see that table and you're going, this must be what someone feels like when, you know, it's like the mm-hmm. Japanese water torture.
Yes, exactly. You know the executioner is coming.
It's like, oh no. You wish an executioner would come. And that crap quick. You know it's going to be an hour and a half of nothing. You know?
I know.
I made myself feel useful and bored you guys, and I made you less productive. So I'm going to leave now, and you can all call me an idiot once I'm on the other side of this big metal door. Okay, bye, everybody. Bye, everybody.
I have vowed to never, ever, ever be that person.
Oh, I don't. There's no chance you do that. There's no chance I do that crap either. I just can't do it.
No.
Now, you move from that, and then comes, dun, 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 the unwritable rant.
Yes, it did.
Now, how can I put this? You're on the talk show podcast. I have my other podcast and I tell stories. Mm-hmm. That's kind of why I gravitated to your show, because we're very, very similar in one way. Storytelling.
Yes.
On the show, your voice, that's it. And I know from personal experience that I take what I write about things that actually happen and I change so much. I will flip the side of the country that the person's from. I will change the city. I will change names. A couple of times I change sexes because I don't want the person to know that I'm talking about them. Or even if they do, they'll go, well, that's cool because you hit me. There's no way in the world. You have to have been doing, it has to be the same way with you.
Well, it really is. Before I did the podcast, I published a book and it was a memoir, and I talked about a lot of people that I dated and knew, and I wasn't quite as good at concealing their identities in that. So I learned very early on that if I'm going to talk about somebody, and I talk about a lot of really famous people on my show, mm-hmm. if I'm going to do that, I need to make it so hard to figure out who this person is. Because I don't want it coming back to me. I don't want that person coming back to me. And I don't want other people coming back to me and going, well, hey, I know who that was. It was so-and-so. No, it wasn't. I mean, when I write a character, it is a character.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all based on things that have actually happened. All of the stories, I mean, those are, you know, I change timeline. I rewrite the person. But they are all incidents that have happened to me.
Well, you can now take this time to, now that the book's been out for a while, I want you to methodically list all the disgusting things people have done and attach it to a name.
We will be here for about 7 years.
Because that is an interesting thing, because I love documentaries and I just chew through biographies, you know. So whenever someone tells something behind the scenes, you know, when you get that kind of insight from somebody, especially someone who's literally like, you weren't hearing the stories. These are things you've seen, done, mm-hmm. been around. You didn't, you know. And so, because that was one of the things I was always fascinated by. Is like, has anyone, and I know, Lord knows you've been asked this question a billion times, but I don't care. I want to know the answer. Has anyone actually recognize themselves, or in my case, what happened to me was I had someone literally call me up and laugh about something someone else did, and it was them I was talking about.
Oh no, really? They didn't even see themselves? That's crazy.
It was the best. I'm going, how did you not remember you did that, you dumb bastard, is what I was thinking. And I'm going, yeah.
Did you let them like stay blind to it? I mean, you just let them think what they thought?
Yep.
Wow. Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
Even now, they're going to listen to this. And you know who you are. You still don't know it was you. So,
you gotta love that.
And I will never say, because this is like, oh, Yvette. It's like, oh, dude, you really, you know. There's got to be stuff in that. That's what I'm curious about. Has anyone recognized themselves or had a situation similar to what happened to me about 200 episodes ago?
You know, if that particular incident, if somebody thought something was about them and were wrong about it, they never brought it to my attention. But yes, I have had one or two people actually come back to me and say, I can't believe you told that about us. And I can't acknowledge that it's about them. I can't put that in writing. I can't say that. So I have to respond and just be like, well, if you see yourself in any of my characters, it was completely unintentional. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even if they're like, hey, you know, damn it, that was me. No, it wasn't you. No.
That, because I just wish that, you know, you could, I wish there was a way that it was some kind of magical power to see the look on your face when the person comes up to you. Was I the one with the camel? No.
It's so funny. There's this one, I don't know if she's still around, but there was a groupie. Her name was Cynthia Plastercaster, and she used to make plaster cast molds of guys' cocks. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, like in the 60s and 70s. So she did everybody. She did, you know, Jim Morrison and Frank Zappa and the, you know, Led Zeppelin and all that. And I was reading an article where she was interviewed, and she said, every so often I get somebody's girlfriend coming up to me and going, you did my boyfriend's cock, you whore. And she'd be like, no, honey, that's wishful thinking on your part. And I always think about that. I mean, what a crazy thing to have somebody come up to you about.
I just can't imagine, you know, just accidentally walking into that person's garage to get the car. There seems to be 75 penises in here. And
yeah. Oh, all of them. It's something, if you like old, you know, groupie stories and stuff about the 70s, you got to look her up. There are some amazing stories that she's told about the people she's been with. It's really, really fascinating.
I just imagine, you know, son, I wanted to show something. I want to show you your old dad here. There it is.
Back in my glory days.
You're damn right. And the room was cold too, Jack.
Well, that's just it. I mean, imagine being in that position, right? I mean, you think it's going to be all sexy and everything, and then you're like jabbing yourself into this pool of cold, whatever it is, plaster casting.
Yeah.
It's not quite as sexy as you hope it's going to be.
Yeah, you got to be in your 20s. Because when you get older, it's like you're gonna need to do this like 3 or 4 times to catch the
yeah. you gotta stock up on your blue chews before.
Right, you gotta be careful. You're gonna catch a bad one here. Everyone's like every 15th time you're gonna catch a bad one. You know, so we're gonna have to.
You know, I think more people would have gone to the Hard Rock Cafe if they had these things on display there.
Ironically, I probably would not have gone to the Hard Rock Cafe.
Oh, come on. You're not curious what, you know, Frank Zappa looks like underneath all of his clothing?
As a matter of fact.
No. As a matter of fact. Who wouldn't be?
The funniest thing is that I would probably go there and laugh so hard when I was there.
That's just it.
Like, did you, you actually laid there and allowed that to happen? Bro.
You can't take it seriously.
Yeah. You know, because, and just like we were saying, I've seen things similar.
Where are you going with this?
Yeah, I've been to some parties myself, and I swear it was a friend of mine. He did something similarly stupid, and we stopped laughing at him, I think, last week.
Well, I will tell you, I am so glad that there were no cell phones when I was, you know, starting my career, because, wow, I would have been in a whole lot of trouble. Everybody I know would have been in a lot of trouble. I think that's why so many rock stars, you know, from the early 80s are, you know, kind of getting away with a lot of crazy behaviors that there's no proof.
Yeah. And I want to say for the record that I did nothing. Thank you. So,
sure. Sure. You didn't.
Of course I was too busy. You know, I was too busy going to church services on Sundays. Mm. And, yeah. And, there's also no proof of that, but that's what I'm going to put on record. Now you move from the book and you slide on over. Now this is the thing I always ask podcasters, people that, to me, podcasting, it seems like home almost, you know what I mean? And so I always knew that I was what's the best way to put this? I'm a little nuts. So,
well, that doesn't hurt.
So I fit right in here, but it's really an interesting journey, because I see people like we were talking earlier, obviously with musicians and people who are doing any kind of performance, comedians, singers, actors, whatever, writers and things of that nature. It's a different type of person that decides to do that, and podcasting is one of those things where. Even it's just now entering the mainstream. So when you started doing it, and definitely when I started doing it such a long time ago, mm-hmm. nobody gave a damn about this crap. And people thought you were stupid for doing it.
Yeah, nobody even knew what a podcast was. And you'd have to be like, oh, well, it's kind of like internet on your phone with the radio. It was kind of like the Wild West.
And you could see their eyes glaze over as you try to explain what it is. Yeah, yeah, sure, bro. Good luck with your little skits, you know.
I know. You know, things.
But when you decided to move from that to this, did it feel like it was something that? Because I know when you went from rock, you know, writing about rock mm-hmm. to the corporate world, I know for a while, just like we were just joking about the other thing with the boardrooms, you have to feel like you're walking around with a cage on you that only you can see. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt. And then you go to the book, and that's you. And then you come to, and obviously, I'm assuming that's more freeing. You're writing your stories your way.
Yes, you know, it's complex, and it's actually funny. Well, not funny. I'm not surprised you brought it up, but it's something that I'm still even struggling with today. You know, after having been doing this for almost 7 years now, mm-hmm. When I started doing it. It was because writing really wasn't a viable way to tell my stories anymore. Mm-hmm. Books were not selling. You know, nobody really cared about buying a book. You know, nobody, the market was oversaturated with blogs that wouldn't have been useful. And I really just wanted to find a way to be able to kind of talk about the stuff that was going on in my life. And I'm sure, you know, I've told the story a million times, but, you know, it was Bill Burr that kind of inspired me to do it, because I was listening to his Monday morning podcast and I liked how he would just be able to sit there and rant and, you know, tell about all the stupid stuff going on in his life and make it entertaining. So I kind of challenged myself and said, okay, well, you know, if he can do it, then I'm going to give it a shot too. And, you know, maybe it'll be good. Maybe it won't. I don't know. And, you know, it started off very differently. I'd kind of like to burn the first 30 episodes or so.
Everybody does. Because,
you know, they're crap. I'm not going to lie. They're utter crap. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once I kind of figured out, okay, you know, just sitting here and babbling is not working. What I can do is treat this more like I would an essay or a short story. And that's where I started developing a more narrative style, where I would be telling a complete story for 20-ish minutes about an event in my life. And at that point, it kind of hit me how cool podcasting was, because it was completely liberating. It was like you said, it's I'm my own boss. I can do whatever I want. I can tell whatever stories I want. And, you know, people either listen or they don't. It's fine. It's cool. But you know, once it started kind of gaining momentum, it was so much fun just, you know, getting all these weird stories out that I wouldn't necessarily put in print. Mm-hmm. And, you know, today, quite honestly, I'm a little burnt out on it, which is why I've taken a step back from it, because I needed to go back to my roots, which is novel writing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've put the show on hold so that I can work on a new book.
Well, you kind of have to, mainly because, you know, it's like bandwidth in your internet. After so many phones of your relatives on Thanksgiving start clacking into your Wi-Fi.
You know, you just start getting stunted. The picture gets fuzzy, you know, it freezes up on you. And I could really feel myself, you know, I still have a wealth of stories to tell, but I want to tell them in a different way now. And I think that's kind of the curse of being a creative, is that, you know, you have to continually challenge yourself in new mediums. You can't just stick to one thing. And after, you know, 7 years of podcasting, it's time to, you know, switch gears a little bit, you know, bump up my internet connection and see what else I can do.
It's an interesting thing because on October, I'm hitting year 8, you know, and it's really weird as a content creator. It's very, you lived in LA, so you'll recognize this reference, rolling brownouts.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I was like, podcasting sucks. I hate this microphone. Podtrack P4, I'm gonna kick your punk ass down the steps. This laptop sucks. This microphone sucks. And then 6 weeks later, I gotta tell this story about the thing with the applesauce. You know, the thing.
It is such a relief to hear you say that, you know, because for a little while I've been like, oh, fuck podcasting. I just, you know, fuck it all. Mm-hmm. I felt bad about that. I really did, because, you know, it's been great and I've loved doing it so much, but, you know, it's hard work. It really is. I don't think people realize how much work goes into doing, you know, a thought out podcast. I mean, how do you handle it? You know, what do you do to keep yourself from going a little even more nutty?
Well, I need that part, but,
but how do you keep it together? I mean, you're going into, you said what, 8 years, 7 years? That's incredible.
Yeah. And I got two of these things. You know what I started to do? It's very similar to, cause I'm in the process of getting myself back in shape physically. I realized that a 20-year-old, if they choose to, can work out at Bally's gym 90 minutes a day, every day, if they want to. A 52-year-old, I may be able to lift the same amount of weights, but it's going to be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you know, mm-hmm. with an active rest day. So I started to realize, wait a second, I know the signs of when I feel burnout coming. I know when it's coming. So now that I know what it feels like when it's coming, I take a small break right at that point where I'm going, no, you don't, you know.
Right.
I take a small break right there, because a lot of times, I've been taking breaks, but I stockpile some episodes. So I'm basically just hitting a button.
And, I see. Right.
And sometimes what I started to notice also, there were people that were doing seasons.
I know. I've seen that. And I don't know if it would necessarily work with the way I format the show, but mm-hmm. I do think it's a good idea.
Oh, no. You don't tell people. You don't tell people it's seasons. No, you don't tell
they're an them. Illusion.
You don't say it's a season, but in your mind you're like, you're getting 15 of these and then I'm taking a break.
Right. So actually that does make sense, because then you would have kind of that end goal, sort of like your summer vacation, so mm-hmm. to speak. Yeah,
it's really weird. It's like when you see if you're running, you're doing a 1500, and I've never done that, if you're doing a 1500 and you're running and you're a lot more tired. You feel like, oh God, 800 meters, I got to go. But the mm-hmm. second you see that line in front of you, you're going, oh, okay.
I got this. I
can
got
get,
this.
I can get to that.
Right. You know?
And then after that, you vomit.
You know, I kind of hit the vomit stage, I mm-hmm. think, which is why I haven't had a new episode out in a month or two, I guess. But mm-hmm. And I've been very hesitant to be definitive about when another episode will come out, because I'm so engrossed in writing the book right now that I don't even want to shift gears. It's this whole new creative high, but I don't want to abandon the podcast either, because I love it. You know, it's my baby. I love that thing.
I understand, because I have to write a brand new 90-minute stand-up show for myself. So when I do it, there's going to be a nice break there. I mean, it won't be a super long break, but there will be a break. And
I mean, there has to be. It's impossible to really do all of that.
And I think that as podcasting has become more mainstream, which is, and I think there's things like Serial and things of that nature that have made it to the point where people now know that podcasts can stop for an extended period of time and then come back.
Yes, I think you're right about that, because that was my fear, but I've kind of looked into it. And I think that is sort of the way that a lot of people treat it. So that's reassuring, because I don't, you know, the big fear is people are going to forget who you are, or they'll just stop caring. And clearly, you know, none of us want that.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I've learned over the years, because, you know, they always say that there's 17 million podcasts now, and podcast is 17 million. How many of those people are actually actively doing it?
You know, it's a good point.
You know, how many of those people have done more than 10? You know, when you've done
isn't that the magic number? They say once you hit 10, you're either in it forever or you're never going to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And they say the average is about, well, they say, yeah, they say the average is 7 to 10.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you. That's an average, because I know people that have done 35. That's enough. This is requiring effort. And no, I thought I could just sit with five friends and yell at each other about beer and yell at each other about how much that quarterback sucks. Oh. And people were going to love to listen to that. No, they're not.
No, they're not. Yeah, I know. That's my greatest frustration, is when people come to me and they're like, hey, you know, my friends and I, you know, we should be on your show because, you know, we always have these great conversations. Like, oh. I'm sure you do. I'm sure they're great, but they're great for you. Yeah. You know, the rest of the world does not have that same perspective.
How do you handle that when a bunch of people hit you with the, I want to be on the show, and you already know it's going to be a damn disaster if that happens? Yeah. You know,
you know, I have two secret weapons. And one of them is David, the producer. Mm-hmm. I funnel them, funnel them through to him. David is far nicer than I am. I mean, eternally nice. Whereas mm-hmm. I'm somebody who will just be like, get the fuck out of my face. And David will take a moment to actually, you know, look into what they want to talk about. And then he'll say, you know what? I'm sorry. We only, you know, we're not doing interviews right now, or, you know, something like that. He's very good at being diplomatic and polite. If it was left up to me, you know, I would burn every bridge.
Okay, listen, David can't hear us right now, right?
Not at the moment.
Good, let's talk about some really disgusting things about David. Let's talk about some stuff I got, I recorded after the show when I had Dave on. This is some really disgusting, gross stuff. Dave is disgusting, and here it is. No, I'm just kidding. It's an interesting thing, because and I want to finish up with this last segment. I want to talk about the part where you when you did the interviews and you had the comics and, mm-hmm. and people like that on the show. Did that feel like home, because you were doing interviews in the beginning?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was one of the reasons we decided to incorporate the interviews in the show, is because it's so in my wheelhouse. You know, when we were talking about ways to grow the podcast audience, we kind of went back to something, I think it was Adam Carolla said, somebody had asked him, you know, how do you have a famous podcast? And he goes, well, you have to be famous or have someone famous on it. And, you know, David, being the producer extraordinaire, he's like, I can make that happen. And I still had a bunch of my contacts in the music industry. So, you know, we were able to book a lot of really, really cool celebrity guests. And it was great. I mean, I liked that I was able to talk to them in a more comfortable format, you know, where it didn't feel like I had to write every word down so that I could get an accurate on paper interview. This way, you know, you just get to be conversational. You get to hang out with somebody a little bit and, you know, get some insight into who they are and what they're doing. And that's, I think, what podcasting is amazing for, mm-hmm. is really getting an insight into somebody in a way that you wouldn't normally.
I keep seeing these people turn podcasts into these movies and miniseries, and ugh.
You said it, I didn't, but I sure thought it.
I'm sitting there going, you know, I'm not going to mention any specific names because I might have to deal with these people, but, you know, I listened to a podcast. I'm going, oh, well, you know, that podcast was awesome. Podcast was incredible. I mean, watch this movie miniseries made. Oh, God.
Although, you know, the thing is, I can't be too harsh about it because I am talking with a production company right now about turning some of the podcast episodes into
a series.
I know that's me and I'm a genius. So,
you know what?
It'll be fine.
You know damn well what I'm talking about. You've had cable in the 80s and 70s.
I know.
You see those stupid movies where this is Three's Company behind the scenes. Doesn't look like John Ritter. Doesn't look like Joyce DeWitt. Doesn't look like Suzanne Summers. The set looks like they broke into somebody's high school at night and shot the episode. And you're going, come on. And if they did a theatrical like S-Town or something like that, they didn't have to be perfect with that one, because if they F that up, people would be really pissed off.
Oh, but people would be rioting in the streets.
Hey, what, John B. played by Malcolm Jamal Warner. What the?
Well, that's the thing, though. And that's, you have to be really careful with your material. Mm. You can't just hand it out to somebody and say, go make me a miniseries, because then you're going to wind up with the janky Three's Company set and some, chick in a bad wig, trashing and just, making your stuff look really horrible. Mm-hmm. It's weird, and having kind of been in a position where, I was talking with people about who would play me in a show about me, and you're looking at these people going, nope, that's definitely not going to work. That's not going to work. Nope. Wrong. Wrong. Everything.
Were you shutting them down at the picture stage, or did you actually,
it was,
cause if they're going to play you, you're going to have to be in the room with that person.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I would demand on that. We never got past the picture stage. I mean, this has been, 2 years in the making right now. Mm. We were very close to going into production for a while, but then COVID shot that down. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of starting from square one again, and it's just a whole process.
I can just imagine you sitting there watching someone play you, if they pick the wrong person.
Oh, I would lose my shit. Going, I would not be okay.
I signed this contract, and I wanted that one right there, and you gave me this lady to right there because you, woo.
Mm-hmm, yeah, no, and then I'd be like the crazy person. Then I'm the crazy person on set giving their notes. And
you know what? If somebody's playing me, my notes are perfect.
Right. I think that's the one codicil on it.
I just really get a kick out of that. But I just, and for the record, they really should do a show about your podcast. I'm gonna be honest with you. They need to get that going.
I want it so badly. We've worked on two different narrative arcs, and my favorite one is actually based on my friendship with the girl that I refer to as Crazy Town.
Crazy Town.
And, yeah, there could be a whole series about just me and her. And that's my personal favorite. I think that could make a great series. We've got a couple scripts on it. It's cool. So I don't know. Who knows? We'll see.
That would be hilarious. I can see now, 3 years from now, a series on Netflix called Crazy Town.
You know what? It's got potential. It really does.
I just think that would be hilarious because, it's just really when it's, because how those things are, when they do it the right way, it just hits.
Yes, exactly.
But for the record, I want to repeat to those of you listening who produce these made for TV movies about podcasts, stop messing them up. Some of these things are really horrible, guys. Stop it. Okay.
Right. Just get it together.
Yeah. Because when you listen to podcasts, they have so much time, for the story. They got 8 hours for the story, and you try to do it in three. And you merge 15 characters together. What happened to his mom? Oh, we took his mom, his aunt, and his grandma, and we merged them into one character. Like, what?
I know. It's so hard.
How does one do that?
if I knew, I would figure out a way to do it myself. It's impossible. I mean, you lose so much that drives a story when you have to do that. And at that point, it's just better to rewrite your through line versus, trying to cram things into what you have that just are out of place.
And I want to apologize to you for lying just now.
You lied.
I just want to say, I said that was going to be the last thing I asked you. Bold-faced lie. I want to find out.
That's okay.
I want to find out about Juliet and Nolens.
Oh, that's my favorite.
Nolens.
I could talk for hours about New Orleans. I could.
And because you know who was talking about New Orleans when I had him on. Mm-hmm. And he seemed to enjoy himself with Nolens.
I gotta say, I am surprised how much David has taken to New Orleans. I mean, he is a very hardworking, you know, very driven guy. And to come to New Orleans where things are considerably more relaxed and, you know, far more, hey, we'll get to it when we get to it. You know, he's embraced it. I mean, David is just, I mean, he fits in so great here. And I love it. We've never had such a great community of people around us. And I'll tell you, so, you know, everybody knows that Hurricane Ida came through and did a lot of damage to not just New Orleans, but, you know, to the coastal areas, especially. It's pretty brutal. We're fortunate in that the French Quarter really only had minor damage, you know, a couple of trees down, some, you know, shingles off roofs, but otherwise, you know, aside from, you know, about a week or so without power, we were good. But where I'm going with this is that we had such a great network of people. Mm-hmm. You know, we've only known them for maybe a year and a half now, and they're like family. You know, they our friends in Florida welcomed us into their home for a week, you know, so that we didn't have to stay here without power. You know, we had people coming over to our house in the middle of the hurricane just so that, you know, they wouldn't be alone, so that they could use our generator. You know, we had a big cookout, you know, when we all came back. You know, I made a big batch of red beans and rice and everybody came over. It's just, it's like having a whole new family here. And I think that's the thing that surprised me about New Orleans the most, is just how much we love the people.
Has being in that environment, because obviously there's got to be a lot of characters there. Okay, I mean, listen, you know,
there
what I mean?
Sure are.
And, you know, because I saw you, I was watching, I saw the two YouTube videos I saw was one where you were on, you guys were, did the beach, you know, where you mm-hmm. know, and the other one where you were at this, it was like a micro museum of wacky items.
Oh, yes, that's our friend Sam. He lives right down the street from us. His Museum of Bad Taste is literally his home, and it is wacky.
Because I'm sitting there, every time, there's certain cities where the moment they're mentioned, obviously you have a picture in your mind. I mean, you know, when someone says New York, you know what comes into your mind. You have a feeling, mm-hmm. an energy that pops into your mind. Same thing with, you know, you lived in Los Angeles, so did I. I lived in Los Angeles for almost the entire 90s. You get an energy there. I've never actually been to New Orleans, but, you know, you get that in the heat of the night feeling where it was like, everybody just relax, man. Everything's going to be all right.
Yeah.
It's,
bro. We all really come together. This is the most resilient city I've ever been in. It's the strongest. It's just, it's an incredible place to continually get to know better.
Is it one of, this is, when I lived in Los Angeles, I was there for the Northridge quake.
Oh, sure, sure. I was there for that too.
Oh, wasn't that sweet? Wonderful way to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I'm coming back from the bathroom and I'm like, it was like 4:30, somewhere around there. I'm like, oh no.
It was bad.
Oh, I mean, as a grown man, you don't normally get picked up and thrown, you know?
I know. Well, you know, I was very young then. I was actually just staying with some friends for an extended vacation. And it was the scariest thing I've ever been through. And we were in Sherman Oaks, and it was brutal.
Yeah, I was living in Hollywood at the time, right? I was living in this dive hotel right behind. It's yeah, I'll say the name, screw it. They can't do anything to me. The Vine Lodge Hotel up the street from Capitol Records.
Oh, I know exactly where that was. I used to work right around Sunset and Vine. Mm-hmm. So
you've probably seen the cavalcade of misfits.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It was literally the closest thing to being in prison and not actually be in prison. I mean, I've never seen any, you know, I just like you have stories about Rock. I could probably give you an hour of just what happened at the Vine Lodge. So it's just, so you have, it was just a weird thing that I saw, like you were talking about the hurricanes, things of that nature in New Orleans, but in Los Angeles, they were so methodical and normal about the earthquake. They just, everything was, and this team showed up and that team had, they were ready, and this team was ready for the cleanup and this team. And I'm assuming, obviously, hurricanes and storms of that nature happen every year or more often, obviously, than earthquakes do. So I can understand how people could have a resiliency in them, because they kind of have to, because they have to deal with this crap all the time, and they just want to live in the city they love.
Right, right.
And yeah, Mother Nature's like, I'm effing up everything.
I know. You better love where you live if that's a part of your, you know, your lifestyle, because I've told all of my friends and family this who have never been through a hurricane. At least where I am, the hurricane isn't the problem. It's the aftermath. Mm-hmm. You know, David and I were here during the hurricane, and we're completely insulated. We were surrounded by brick. I was a little worried about our magnolia tree, but it was fine. The problem comes after the fact, when you have all of this debris and you have all of these power outages. And the one unfortunate thing about New Orleans is that they have been very, very slow on the cleanup. You know, we had the National Guard here. We had FEMA here. So they've been working hard to keep people safe and to provide, you know, resources and get, you know, the power going, getting internet back up. But the cleanup itself is really, really lagging. And that's unfortunate.
I don't even think they get an opportunity to breathe. It's like somebody re-breaking your leg in the same place. As soon as it starts to set, somebody comes up with and cracks you. Yeah. Like, I just healed the damn leg. The skin. Sorry, buddy. Bow.
I know. It's so unfortunate. The city was just starting to come back. Businesses were opening, you know, after having been shuttered for a while. And then the hurricane hits. And now, you know, we have floodwaters coming in from the tropical storm. So we all just want quiet now, I think.
Now, where originally, your original home?
Chicago.
Okay, so do you feel like a Chicagoan?
I never felt like a Chicagoan.
I didn't think so.
Never once, no.
Because I was going, I got to hear this city. And I'm going, there's, you know, and I'm sitting there going, if she says like New York or, you know, or something like that, I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. And then my next question is going to be, do you feel like your friend, because it, like, are you a sports person?
No, although part of the assimilation process in moving to New Orleans means I do have to be a Saints fan.
That was the next question. I was going to say they're going to corrupt you into becoming a Saints fan, and it's hard not. I mean, you know, especially when in a city where they just embrace certain cities. Like if you lived in my hometown, oh, you can best believe you're going to be wearing green.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You know, you're going to have an Eagles hat on and the people are going to look at you like, what the hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. Put that damn hat on. Eat this steak and calm down. I'm not even in Philadelphia right now. Yeah, we know. I was like, hey, I may not be in it, but I'm from there, damn it. So shut up with your New Jersey asses.
Right.
You know, so when you, so right now I'm going to finish up with, you said you're working on the book now. And how is that going?
It's really, really good. So I decided to do something that was completely out of my wheelhouse. I could have done another memoir. I could have done another collection of essays. I decided to go with a young adult novel, and it's a supernatural story. It's called My Mother is a Witch. And it's about a girl who has all the problems of a teenager and all the powers of a witch. And she has to figure out how to navigate both of them. It's really fun to write. It's nice to not be writing about myself. You know, it's nice to be writing fiction so that I can kind of go wherever I want. You know, I'm not bound by, you know, the realities of my story. So if I stay on schedule, and knock on wood, I will, I would like to have the book completed by the end of the year.
Feels good to be able to dive into other characters, doesn't it?
It does. It's a relief to get out of my own head. It's like, I'm over myself, you know, let me just focus on somebody else for a little while.
That's the thing I always tell people. Why do you do so many characters in the thing? Because I have an opportunity to be somebody else for 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
So why not?
It's more liberating than I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. And that, and that's the, and also, you know, when you, it's just like anything else. When you get really good at something, you either push the envelope or open up an, or start another one. It just, it's just the way it is, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a growth process. And that
when
is
you
got
to keep moving forward, you know.
You're damn right. That's why I'm starting 7 new podcasts.
Oh, look at you, overachiever. Show off.
Remember that TV show, 8 is Enough?
You know, I don't think they were talking about podcasts.
No, well my TV show is going to be called 2 is Enough, because these two damn things is enough. 2 is all he's getting. You're getting. This is all I'm doing. Somebody talking about, are you going to do another one? I'm like, are you out of your damn mind? 2 is enough.
I gotta say, I am so blown away that you're able to manage the two of them. I mean, that's huge.
I have to not think about it. I have to not think about it. I don't acknowledge the other one. Hold on for a minute. Do a little. Let me get in the lotus position right now.
I know.
Put some incense up.
Rock back and forth a little bit. Yeah. It'll be fine.
Oh my goodness. And the most important thing is, before I just want to thank you for giving me the time. I really appreciate it. I enjoy talking to you, and you know, it's fun to actually be listening to you talk when you're actually talking and I get to talk back to you. Now that's the fun part too.
Yeah, isn't that the cool thing? Like, you know, like you were saying before, you know, we know each other, but, you know, we don't really know each other. And to be able to have a conversation like this is just so cool. I've had so much fun talking to you.
Yeah, you two, you guys, you know, I have a strong affinity for D the P.
Yes, yes. Everybody likes him better than me, and I don't blame them.
Well, I got news for you. Compared to you, he stinks. Yeah, I said it.
Oh,
that's right.
Smooches.
Yeah, Dave's great, but can he can hear me right now. Listen, I'm sorry, man. She's better than you. Okay, deal with it.
You know what? I will say, I joke about it, but David is. I mean, he's a hell of a producer, but he's a hell of a partner. Like I could never have achieved half of what I have without him with me.
Yeah, I mean,
he's a special person.
I really like both of you, and it was a pleasure talking to both of you. And but for the record, Juliet's better than Dave. So anyway,
Hashtag Team Juliet.
Oh, my friend, thank you very much for coming on, and I will continue as always to torture you both on Twitter.
Now before
we go, you said the podcast is on hiatus right now. It doesn't matter. You still got a lot of great stuff there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to link up, obviously, so everybody can listen to all the great work that you've already done.
There's 258 episodes. Start with episode 258, work your way backwards, and you will have a good time.
Like she said, make sure you pay a lot of attention to the first 30 of them.
Yes.
but not mine. Mine, skip the first 30 of mine. Don't listen to that.
That's what we're going to do. I'm going to listen to all your first 30 episodes. See how you like it.
My friend, thank you very much, and much love to both of you. I'm a big fan of you guys as performers and as people. I think you're awesome.
Oh, thank you. Feelings mutual.
All right, take care. Much love to you.
You too.
Okay, bye bye. All right, everybody. Thank you very, very much for listening to another show. All the new listeners that are coming on, I want to thank you for coming and hanging out. All the people that have been listening to me for the whole time, once again, much love to you all. The family is growing, and I love every last one of you. If you love this show, and you did, do me a favor, rate and review this podcast on whatever podcatcher you're playing. 17 stars, please. Okay? If you haven't subscribed, make sure that you do. And tell a friend to tell a friend to tell a friend about the podcast, okay? Much love to you all. We'll see you again next time. I appreciate you. I love every last one of yous, and we're going to have more fun in the future. Thank you, and I'll see you next time, my friends. Take care.